fact, they take the opportunity in the absence of Professor Pisser, who is our DVC, who I think is stuck in traffic, like probably all the rest of us have been today, to welcome Prof. Robin Catchpole. Prof. Catchpole has, I'm sure as many of you are aware, good South African links, because he was here at the South African Astronomical Observatory for some 23 years in South Africa between Cape Town and Pretoria. So he's been here for a long time. But he is at the present working at the Institute of Astronomy at Cambridge University. And it's nice to see this word retire as senior astronomer at the Royal Observatory in Greenwich in 2003. So clearly is very active life beyond retirement. So thank you very much, Prof, and to hand over to you.
Thanks very much. Love it. I'll just get plugged in here. Okay, hopefully everybody can hear me. We have had problems with sound for some of these lectures. Well, what I want to do over the course of this week is to introduce you to sort of what we know about the universe. In other words, to try and give you a feel of where we are in the field of astronomy right now. Now, I know there's a wide variety of backgrounds in the people in this audience. And so what I hope is that there'll be something for everybody in my lectures, but possibly not everything for anybody, if you see what I mean. So if you sort of suddenly start thinking, oh my gosh, this is getting a bit much, well, you know, just give it a chance, just to sit back and enjoy the pictures. And just to sort of warn you, maybe this first lecture, my wife always says I should do the lectures the other way around, but this is kind of the overall view. And, you know, dark matter, vacuum energy, some of you will have heard of these things, and quite a lot of you, I gather, were in the LHC lecture last week, so you will know much more about the early universe than I do. And, but, you know, some of these ideas are rather unusual. Now, I'm also, being an astronomer, I'm not used to working in daylight. I find it very... so I'm going to put the lights out, and then I feel more attacked. Thank you. Okay. Now, before I start, I want to say something about light. Because if you think of it, light is the only means we have of exploring the universe, with a few. There are always exceptions. There are neutrinos and things that we can pick up, asteroids and bits of asteroids, meteorites that land on the surface of the Earth. But light is essentially it. We can't go out there and stick thermometers in stars. We rely on light. And light is, as it were, the messenger of the universe. It brings us useful information about its source. And I'm sure many of you will have done this experiment at school where you take a beam of white light and you put, in this case, a diffraction grating in front of it, and we split the light up into its component colors. What we're actually doing is sorting the light according to its wavelength. And this is the way that we get the information from the light. So if we now go to a more familiar scene, a street scene here, in fact out in Milnerton, and here we have some street lights, and what I did was to put the diffraction grating in front of the camera to make a spectrum, the way I'm doing it now, and you will see instead of having a continuous band of light as we did in the last experiment, we now have a series of what we call bright emission lines. And this pattern of lines is the unique signature of the element mercury that is present in the streetlights. So I have this almost miraculous power that with this piece of plastic I can deduce the composition of a distant light source. And in fact, if I was to measure very carefully the relative intensities of these lines here, I would be able to work out the physical conditions inside this light source. The temperatures, the pressures, and so on and so forth. And so that is the underlying physics of astronomy, spectroscopy, the ability to analyze light. And whereas this piece of plastic cost a few cents, a modern spectrograph on the back of a telescope might weigh as much as a motor car and cost maybe $10, $60, $70 million or so. And of course, with that, we can probe the nature of galaxies and quasars to the edge of the observable universe. Now, light has another important property, and that is it travels at a finite speed. And this gives us a handy unit of distance, namely the light year. And I want to try and demonstrate that to you. It's very difficult to demonstrate the speed of light. Now, why have I got a picture of the Earth here? Because in 1 second, a beam of light is capable of circling the Earth 7.5 times. That gives you some idea of its speed. So what I've got here, instead of the Earth, or even a picture of the Earth, is a tennis ball. And I want you to imagine now the tennis ball represents the Earth. And I've got a piece of string that I managed to completely tangle up here, but let's untangle it very quickly. And if I take this piece of string, of course I've done this before, it's exactly long enough that I can wrap it round the tennis ball 7.5 times. So if we assume that the tennis ball now represents the Earth to scale size, then the distance, the length of this piece of string is the distance that light travels in 1 second. It's just slightly less than the distance of the Earth to the Moon, about 1.2 light seconds. So this is a distance of 1 light second. Now, we talk about light years in astronomy, and how much string do you think I need to represent a light year? Well, the mathematics or the arithmetic is fairly simple. You just multiply all these numbers together to find the length of the light year in kilometers. Well, it's enough string of this gauge to fill 5 standard containers, you know, those ship containers, or it's enough string to go around the real world, the world we are standing on, about 1.25 times. So light year is, you know, it's quite a long distance. So that's really, you know, the best idea I can give you for the scale and the speed of light, and so on. Now, light travels at a finite speed, and this gives astronomers a unique advantage over every other science. It means as we look deep into space, we also look back in time. So when we look at the Moon, we see it the way it was a second ago. Well, so what? It doesn't change much in a second, nor does the Sun in 8 minutes. But it has enabled us to draw, to look, as we look deep into space, to look back in time and draw this timeline. From today up there, where it says naught, we look back to the beginning of the universe, the start of the universe. And I will show you how we estimate the age of the universe later on. And you can see, it goes back 14,000 million years. We can put events up here, like the birth of the Sun. And you will see something called 2DF survey, which we'll look on. And it's only in the last, 20 years, since the Hubble Space Telescope has been launched, that we have had the ability to look significantly far back through deep into space and back into time to see a universe that looks very different from the one we live in today. And really the ultimate with a telescope is the Hubble ultra-deep field that looks back to when the universe was about a 20th of its age. Now what I want to do is to show you what we've got in the universe and, as it were, travel deep from where we are back in time through space. And of course, we have to start with our Sun, and we will be looking in more detail at our Sun later on in this course. Our Sun is about just over 8 light minutes away on our scale, and we have the transit of Venus. Venus is going to cross the Sun again this year, and a bird's doing it just to symbolize life. Our Sun, of course, is at the center of our solar system, and here is a rather unusual portrait of our solar system made up of a whole series of images taken by the Voyager 1 spacecraft. And there in the center is the Sun with Venus, Earth, and Jupiter lost in the blaze of scattered light. But we come out to Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Of course, we'll be looking at those planets in more detail later on. And the scale of this now, from the Sun to Neptune, is about 4 hours. So that is the scale of, the planetary system in our solar system. The comets and so on are much further away. So we go from a scale size of 4 hours, 4 light hours, in terms of the travel of the speed of light. We move out into the sky. And here is a piece of sky that will be very familiar to you in the southern hemisphere, showing the two pointers and the Southern Cross. And if you can't see them, there they are, the two pointers of the Southern Cross. And the wonderful thing about the brighter of the two pointers is that it is at a distance of 4.4 light years, which is the closest star we know to us. And that is, so we are going from a scale of light hours for our solar system to light years to the nearest star. And note that the two pointers, the lower one is at a distance of 4.4 light years, the upper one looks about the same brightness as at a distance of 500 light years. So that is 100 times further away, which means if they look the same brightness, then that other star must be intrinsically about 10,000 times brighter. And of course, the story of stars and stellar evolution is again something we will look at in more detail later on. But so that when the sky darkens a bit more and we look around the night sky, we see it's full of stars and we see the Milky Way emerging in our field of view. So here we are looking at stars, the closest to which is 4 light years away. Typically, they are the ones we see with the naked eye are at distances of hundreds of light years, perhaps out to, for the very brightest, to 1,000 light years. Now, you're all familiar with the idea that we can project the entire surface of the globe onto a map, and this is called an Eitoff projection because it assigns equal areas. There's no distortion of area, there is distortion of shape. Well, in the same way we can display the sphere of the Earth, we can display the enclosing sphere of the sky on a similar projection. And if we do this, this is a projection we see of the entire night sky, and it shows the entire span of the Milky Way. And down here we see the two Magellanic clouds that I'm sure many of you will be familiar with. Now, we live in a galaxy, but it's not clear what the shape of this galaxy is, because we can see there's a lot of dark, obscuring patches here. And this is because our galaxy is full of dust and gas. And indeed, if we look at this view of the entire night sky and compare it with that of a close-up image of a distant galaxy, we can see the similarity between that and what we are looking at here. Now, in order to see past the dust and gas, we need to put on our infrared glasses. And if we do that, and here we are using the results of a satellite image that shows some 500 million stars, to their relative brightness, we begin to see that the plane of the galaxy gets much thinner here, and we see a bit of a bulge appear in the middle. There are the two Magellanic clouds. Now, the way to look at this is to imagine a sort of perspective situation. We are immersed in a disk. So around, the bright stars are sort of uniformly, well, fairly bright stars spread around us. But as we look towards the centre, there's a perspective effect, because it's like two railway lines. The whole display converges towards the centre, so you get that sense there. Another way of looking at this data is not to represent the stars by brightness, but just by number density. So one spot for each star. And then the structure becomes more apparent. The bulge becomes more apparent. The Magellanic clouds, you can see a clustering of stars there. And the nearby stars aren't dominating this. And if you look very, very closely, you will see what appears to be a little finger poking up here. And interestingly enough, that is a small galaxy that is colliding with our galaxy on the opposite side of the centre to us. So this is a view containing 35 million sources here, all displayed as an image, and clearly shows a representation of our galaxy that you can see is very analogous to this image of a distant galaxy. And if we were to look at this sort of galaxy face on, it would look something like this. And so this is the sort of environment we live in. We live towards the edge of one of these spiral arms. The distance from where we are to the centre is about 25,000 light years. And in fact, this is an artist's representation of what we think our own galaxy looks like. It's very, very difficult to reconstruct this three-dimensional structure from sitting in the plane at this distance. So 25,000 light years from here to here. Now, if you look at this thing, it looks as though it ought to be rotating. These spiral arms ought to be rotating, and indeed it is. We are out here, we feel the gravitational tug of all the mass that's inside our orbit, and the stable orbital velocity here is about 200 kilometers per second. So the Sun is going around about 200 kilometers per second, but nevertheless, it takes about 220 million years to go around once. So this is indeed a very, very big object. When we look at galaxies, we just see this lovely sort of haze of stars. What you have to remember is there's an awful lot of empty space, something like 50 million diameters, star diameters between adjacent stars. Now, we've only really had this view of our universe as made up of individual galaxies for the last 80 years or so. And that is largely, almost entirely, thanks to this man, Hubble, who looked at other galaxies, and we'll see other galaxies in a minute, he looked at other galaxies in the sky, and he sort of, measured their velocities. And he looked very carefully, and he was able to see stars that varied in brightness, and he was able to compare those stars with similar stars close to home in our own galaxy. We don't have time to go into the whole calibration of distance, which is a series of lectures in itself, fundamental to astronomy, but if he could estimate the distance of those distant stars and measure the velocities of galaxies, he suddenly realized that these velocities were much larger than the velocities of stars, and therefore deduced that these galaxies were very distant and that we were living in an expanding universe. But before that, people had speculated that maybe a galaxy was a sort of solar system in the process of formation. And indeed, when we make models of solar systems forming, we see similar spiral arms emerging. But of course, they're not. They're made out of hundreds of thousands of millions of stars. So let us continue our voyage out into space to come to our nearest neighbouring galaxy, the Great Nebula in Andromeda, M31, at a distance of about 2.5 million light years. So we're now in the millions of light years. And this is a galaxy very similar to our own. Our galaxy and this galaxy are the major galaxies in our local group, and each of them has a series of these dwarf galaxies. You see these fuzzy things here, and many fainter dwarf galaxies, not visible in this particular image, that surround them. So we both have our halo of dwarf galaxies. Now, I always think it's quite fun to try and sort of think about things, so let us just imagine that there are some astronomers going around orbiting a star somewhere in this galaxy, and they are looking back at our galaxy. And of course, they have telescopes much more powerful than anything we have, so they're capable of looking at us on the surface of our Earth. What will they see? They will not see our cars parked on the campus here. They will see the way the world was about 2.5 million years ago. They will not see the mobile phones, they will see the tool of choice was not a mobile phone, but a hand axe, and the world will be the world of Mrs. Pless and the Australopithecines. And so I think it's quite fun to speculate. We know these stars are radiating light today. What will the photons from the stars in this galaxy, what sort of world will they impinge on in another 2.2 million years? Will there be any hominids or hominid representatives around? Who knows? Anyway, let us move on, because if we want to start doing some serious astronomy to really understand our universe, we have to go a lot further than 2.2 million light years. We have to go to a distance here of the Virgo cluster of galaxies, and each of these fuzzy things is a galaxy. They're up there, and at a distance of about 60 million light years. Now, when you look at these fuzzy blobs, you have to just bear in mind galaxies like our own, 100,000 million stars. Now, this is a very important, very critical distance for astronomy, because at this distance, the Hubble Space Telescope is still just capable of resolving individual stars. It can go a bit further. We're going to look at the member of the Virgo cluster up the top there in a bit more detail. I should just hasten to add that, of course, whenever we look into the universe, we're looking out of our galaxy, so we have this sort of interfering kind of uniform spread of stars. So all the stars are close to home. So let us now zoom in on the galaxy up in the top right there. And this is one of the Hubble telescope imaging devices. And this is the field. And you can't resolve them with a projector here. But it's possible to resolve individual stars here. Now, some of those individual stars are variable stars called Cepheid variables. And we know their distance, and we know their absolute brightness in our own galaxy. We can measure their brightness here. So by comparing the brightnesses using the 1 over r squared law, the way brightness gets fainter with distance, we can work out how far away this galaxy is in, I don't know, light years, kilometers, parsecs, whatever your unit of choice is. And we can take the light of this thing and measure its redshift. How fast is that galaxy moving away from us? Now, at 60 million light years, the universe is expanding enough that these velocities are quite large, 1,500 kilometers a second, typically. So much greater than the random velocities the galaxies have. So we have something that takes us back to our good old schoolboy mathematics, a very, very simple sum, speed times time equals distance. Now, the nature of a uniformly expanding universe is the nature of the way these cars are behaving. Here we've got a traffic cop. He's looking at this car. It's going at 5 kilometers an hour, and it happens to be 10 kilometers away. This one is twice as far away, and it's going twice as fast. So if we know the distance and we know the speed, we can work out the time when the little cars were at the starting line. And that is what we want to know. We can measure the speed of those galaxies, we can measure their distance. We want to know when the galaxies were all in one place, that is the moment when the universe was born, when it started. And so, we can do this little sum, and it's 2 hours in the case of this model here. But now, the trouble with astronomers is, for historical reasons, we kind of like to do the one thing you were always taught to do at school, never mix your units. So instead of having a very simple little equation that looks like that, we talk about the Hubble constant, H0, 71 kilometers per second per megaparsec. Right, kilometers are a distance. In kilometers, you know about those megaparsecs. A parsec is 3.2 light years, and a megaparsec is a million. So we've completely mixed up our units here for historical reasons. So it is not even remotely obvious that if we take 1 over H0, we get the age of the universe. And that is something that people find very confusing. It is just as simple as that. H0, in the case of this example, would be correctly expressed, would be 0.5 kilometers per hour per kilometer. Those two units cancel out, so it's 0.5 times hours to the minus 1. 1 over that is 2 hours. Well, 1 over 71 kilometers per second per megaparsec turns out to be 13,777 million years, but you wouldn't necessarily not see that. And it could be, I just labor that because a lot of people just come across that and don't realize just how simple the idea of Hubble constant is. Now, this is a summer school, not a summer entertainment, so we have graphs. And so... this is a very simple graph, time along here, size here, scale. And this is the present day. So what if we measured? This slope here represents a speed, and the speed we measured for the Hubble constant, if we assume that the speed is forever constant, then we come back to when the size equals naught, when everything was together, and that is what we call the Hubble time, or our first approximation to the age of. Now, the interesting thing is that when we come to consider the universe, we have to consider Einstein's theory of general relativity, and that's, a bit beyond the extent of my brain, so we have to think of things in more simple terms. But what essentially what Einstein recognized was that gravity is the ruling force in the universe. And so mass and energy are the things that provide gravity. So if we have an expanding universe, what will slow down the expansion? The material in the universe. And so he recognized that for a given velocity today, which is all we measure, the universe can have a range of possible futures depending how much mass energy there is in it. If there's a lot, then like throwing keys up in the air and they come down again, the universe will expand for a while and then it will contract and it will recollapse. If there's not so much mass, it might effectively go on expanding forever and ever. So the critical thing that astronomers needed or wanted to find out was what is the critical density. The critical density is called the density that brings the universe to a halt at an infinite size, and they could try and find that by trying to find the density of matter in the universe. Well, when they first did that with stars, they found that essentially there was no matter in the universe. It would just expand forever. But as you will see, the story gets a bit more complicated. But now we must take a slight diversion because we're at this critical distance of 60 million light years, just only critical because of the equipment we have, but there are quite a lot of galaxies at that sort of distance. And galaxies come in a wonderful range of shapes and sizes. And this is not a montage, this is a Hubble field just showing three different galaxies. And you see this one has what we call a peanut-shaped bulge. Some of them have more ordinary ones. Here is a barred spiral, two great spiral arms and a sort of bar in the middle there. And here is quite a different galaxy. Each of these, this haze here, is 100,000, typically 100,000 million stars. This disk here of dust and gas, and here is another more extreme example of a galaxy with an edge-on disk, and see the haze of stars around it. And what we have come to realize is that the wide variety of shapes and sizes and forms of galaxies we see are the results of collisions and interactions. And in some cases, you can see those interactions taking place. And in fact, we've come to realize that the shape, whether it's a spiral or an elliptical, is just the current shape of the galaxy as a result of its previous history of collisions, after its last collision. Now, I have to say, as the universe gets bigger and everything gets further apart, galaxy collisions become rarer, but and were much more important early on in the history. And I'm just showing you these lovely images because they are so beautiful and so varied. And the dark stuff there is dust and gas. And in this case, we see two galaxies performing a dance around each other. Now, what I want to do is to show you one of these simulations. Now, let's hope the simulation starts. Let's just press once. This little movie runs for 1,000 million years in that time, not in real time, fortunately. And it shows the interaction of, it'll rerun, we have an edge on, disks at right, rotating disks at right angles to each other, and they collide. And the red stuff, just to preempt my lecture, is called dark matter, which plays an important role in this. And you will see how the two nuclei perform a dance around each other and then merge. And you will see during the course of this computer-simulated collision how we see those great arms of stars sweeping out, you see, just like we do in the collision of the two galaxies. So we can simulate things in our computers, and dark mass plays an important role, as I'll say. And there is an image of this thing that we see in detail with the Hubble Space Telescope. So what happens in a galaxy collision? Well, the two nuclei perform a dance around each other and probably merge, and the dust and gas within the galaxy is stirred up by the gravitational tugs of the interaction and triggers a huge burst of star formation. And when you see all these bright blue images here, these are young, hot, newly born stars. Now, in fact, our galaxy is undergoing a minor collision right now on the opposite side, and will, in, I don't know, the order of 1,000 million years or so, or maybe a bit longer, it will merge with the Andromeda galaxy. Now, actually, we won't be around, and even the Sun may not be around, but if it was, we wouldn't have to worry, because there is such enormous distances between individual stars that they will just pass each other by, perhaps form a dance, a sort of waltz around each other at very, very much at arm's length, but the stars will not collide. We trigger the formation of stars out of dust and gas, but collisions do not occur with stars. Now, one of the things that we have discovered about galaxies, and undoubtedly here in the central bulges, there will be massive black holes, that all galaxies have black holes, about 1% of the mass of their bulges. And I want to look in particular at this galaxy, which has a notorious black hole, and it's also a radio source. It has been formed as the result of a collision with a spiral galaxy, an elliptical galaxy, some time ago, and so what I want to do is to zoom in on it using ground-based telescopes, and we see the dust and gas, and then eventually, here we have the Hubble Space Telescope, see the haze of new stars. Recognize this white haze here is the light from unresolved stars. It's not gas or anything. Note here the red color, the reddening. You realize you will know how the Sun itself is reddened at sunset because the light shines through a lot of dust in the Earth's atmosphere. That's exactly what's happening here. The light of the background stars is shining through dust. Zoom in towards the middle. Here we are using the fullest resolution of the Hubble Space Telescope. And now we can flip over to one of the infrared cameras on the Hubble Space Telescope that punches through the dust and gas and reveals a very bright object right at the center of this galaxy. And this is the location of a black hole. Now, if we could... We've never seen a black hole in one of these galaxies in close-up, but if we could, it would probably look like this. The black hole itself is hidden inside a rapidly rotating accretion disk of dust and gas. The outside is dark. The inside, the swirling of the gas becomes so rapid, the friction between the gas covered by magnetic fields becomes so great, the temperature rises to millions of degrees, as we will see. So what is a black hole? And why? How can a black hole be so bright? Well, a black hole is simply the situation that arises if you gather enough mass into a small enough volume such that the gravitational force of that mass means that the escape velocity will be equal to the speed of light. Now, if you wanted to make the Earth into a black hole, you'd have to cram the whole thing into a volume, not this size, but this size in relation to the palm of my hand. In other words, about a little bit smaller than the ping pong ball. You'd have to crush the entire mass of the Earth into that volume. It would be totally impossible. There are no laws of physics that could take the Earth and crush it into that volume. But that would be an Earth mass black hole. If we had a black hole as we do at the centers of galaxies, that is about, in the case of the one we're looking at, 3,000 million times the mass of the Sun, then all you have to have is about a solar system volume of air at the pressure of air in this room, and that would spontaneously form a black hole. So, for large mass things, it's much easier to create a black hole. So, let us just briefly look at the very brief physics of a black hole. Well, I put singularity here. That's what there is in the center of a black hole. We have no idea whatever what the conditions are inside a black hole. The laws of physics that we have do not describe this situation. This is the struggle of N theory and string theory to try and come up with physics that will explain what is here. As far as we are concerned, there is an event horizon, And that is the radius at which the escape velocity is equal to the velocity of light. That is the point beyond which we do not see. That is the point beyond which whatever is in here becomes detached from our universe. All that we can feel are an electron, magnetic field, gravitational field, and that there would be a magnetic or electric field if it was not neutral. So this is the event horizon. Once crossed, no return. Around that is something called the ergosphere, and the ergosphere is a region close to the surface, close to the event horizon, where space and time are, as it were, dragged around at the same speed that the black hole is rotating, because black holes have angular momentum. Around that, we have this accretion disk. Now, as matter falls in, it doesn't go straight into the black hole. You have to aim incredibly accurately to get a bullet to go straight into a black hole. Slightly, you know, a fraction of a second of half off, all it does is go into orbit around it. The faster, the closer you are, the faster it orbits. The further out, the more slow. So there's a sort of differential drag between material at different distances in the disk. And that drag is given to us by the magnetic fields that are threading through this electrically conducting plasma that may be at the temperature of tens of millions of degrees. Magnetic field is drawn in. Some of it is twisted up into spirals above and below as the field disconnects. And we have two jets that emerge from this accretion disk. And when we now come back to look at our galaxy, and remember this is about 100,000 light years, so maybe this jet spreads out 200,000 light years into space from something no bigger than our solar system in the middle, we see evidence, synchrotron radiation, X radiation from particles, from protons, electrons that are spewed out along with other matter out above and below the galaxy. So all galaxies, including our own, have black holes at their centers. Now, here is another galaxy called M87, much more massive than our own. Each of these blobs, incidentally, is not a star, but what's called a globular cluster, a collection of about a million stars or more. Our galaxy has a few of these. This has a lot. Now, if we peer into this with a Hubble, then we see this jet, about 3,000 light years long, emerging from a bright nucleus. Most of this nucleus is made up of stars in this case. Now, this is one of the jets that emerges from the black hole. In fact, they're electrons, and when they get a twist in a magnetic field, they emit synchrotron radiation. That's why you don't see it. It's a bit like somebody said, water flowing down the stream, and when there's a boulder, the water foams around the boulder. Well, it's the electrons meeting the magnetic field that cause the foaming there. Now, that jet is clearly moving sideways from our line of sight. That's why we see it like that. But imagine the jet pointing towards us. And it was only when we had the Hubble Space Telescope that we were able to solve the mystery of objects discovered back in the 60s called quasi-stellar objects, quasars. And we realized that these were simply very, very bright objects where the jet, or like a laser beam, happened to be pointing right into our faces. And that's the situation we have here. And we can see the faint image of a galaxy lurking behind at the edge of these jets. Okay, that's enough about black holes and quasars and jets. And let us get back to the structure of our universe. Now, here is a beautiful picture, and I want you to completely ignore the lovely galaxies spewing across it, and look closely at all the faint galaxies you see. This is absolutely full of individual little galaxies. There are three bright stars there, but everything else is a galaxy. Now, we have a method of measuring the distance to a galaxy by measuring its redshift. And when we found the age of the universe, we effectively calibrated that distance in terms of distance and speed. We knew at what distance does a thing have what speed. And we can measure the speed by measuring the redshift, how fast the thing is moving away from us. And what the astronomers did, really, at the end of the last century, was to produce this amazing map of the local universe. Now, let's just explain what we've got here. So we're in the middle, and what the astronomers did was to observe a strip of sky over there, and a strip of sky over there, not very wide, and they measured the redshift of every single galaxy in each of those strips. And if it had a large redshift, it would be far out and put as a point. If it was a small redshift, it would be close in. And so this is a map, if you like, in the third dimension, between us and that sky, of all the distribution of galaxies. There are about 250,000 galaxies in this particular project. And you will see there is quite clear structure. I should perhaps point out the galaxies thin out here. This survey is probably complete to about this distance, which incidentally, look at this, is now 1,000,000,000 light years. We're going serious distance here now, 1,000,000,000 light years. Beyond here it thins out because we can only see the brightest galaxy. But you will see what looks like what is being described as a foam-like structure. Galaxies are not uniformly distributed. They seem to be in walls with voids like bubbles in them here. And this tells us something very fundamental and very important about the nature of the universe, that it is not uniform. If the universe, the distribution of matter is like waves in the sea. On a stormy day, you get big waves and small waves down on the beach. Go up to the headland and overlook the sea, and the horizon looks uniform and reasonably flat, even on the stormiest of days. So on the large scale, bigger than about 300,000,000 light years or so, the universe is the same wherever we look. And we will see that this structure owes its existence to a time when the universe was smaller than the tiniest, even much, much smaller than the tiniest electron or any other elementary particle. Now, there is a problem with this survey, and that is that, and this is a segment of it, that we're here, and when we calibrate it, the distance speed calibration, we only did it out to these sort of distances. And so we're extrapolating and assuming the same law applies over the whole thing. Very dangerous thing to do in science. So what we need is another way of determining distance. Unfortunately, we have one, and it is to use a supernova that can outshine an entire galaxy and always goes off with more or less the same brightness. So there are details there, but now supernovae are very rare. We haven't seen one in our own galaxy for several hundred years. But if we look very, very deep into space, where there are literally thousands of galaxies in our field of view, then we can see a few every month or two. And so it was possible to observe those. Now I want to show you an example here of a supernova at a distance. Now look, here we've got a cluster, here we've got a galaxy with what looks like a hot pixel enlarged. There is evidence for a supernova that's exploded. Now, you remember when we calibrated our Hubble law, we went out to 60,000,000 light years. 60,000,000 years ago on Earth, maybe the dinosaurs were wandering around. Well, this cluster of galaxies is at a distance of now 8,000,000,000 light years. So what does that mean in practical terms, to give us a sense of scale? Well, the age of the solar system is only 4,500,000,000 light years. So the light that ended up going down the spout of the Hubble Space Telescope and forming this image had been travelling through space for almost twice the age of our solar system. But fortunately, we were around to catch the photons to record the supernova. Now, when the calculations were made, we could have redshift to give us one distance, we had the brightness of the supernova to give us another, and we found, to our surprise, that the supernova were too faint in relation to the redshift. Now, I don't have time to really go into explaining all that, but the consequence of that is that we deduced that the universe was doing the one thing that nobody thought it was capable of doing, and that was that it wasn't. So we got our Hubble constant today, and what we've been doing is measuring the behavior of redshift with time back in time towards the beginning. What we have discovered is that although the universe started slowing up, about 5,000,000,000 years ago, it started speeding up, accelerating, in other words, going faster and faster. The one thing that we never thought it would do, because we said that mass and energy were bound to slow it down. But here we have a form of energy that, although it contributes to the mass energy that defines the geometry of the universe through Einstein's laws, is providing a force that is causing space to expand much faster than ever as time goes on. It's causing space to expand ever faster and faster. And so the universe is, the expansion of the universe is accelerating, and that force is referred to as sometimes dark energy or vacuum energy. And the nature of that is still a bit of a mystery. So, I've introduced you to dark energy. Now I'm going to introduce you to dark matter, which is closer to home, but, you know, in terms of showing the pictures, as it were, comes more logically after vacuum energy. So let us get back to looking at things. And now we're only a couple of thousand million light years from home, looking at this vast cluster of galaxies. All these orange, these yellow things are clusters of galaxies. Sorry, this is a vast cluster. And you will see these arcs here that are concentric with this most massive cluster here. Here they are, arcs, distorted images of more distant galaxies. This is what is called a gravitational lens. And to show you the geometry of the situation, it is like this. The picture we just looked at, if this is the picture plane, as it were, shows that cluster of galaxies with the distorted image. So we are looking from here. And it is the mass in this cluster, the mass that is distorting light. Something Einstein predicted and something Newton predicted said would be the case. So we have a distant galaxy here, and the light rays go off in all directions from the distant galaxy. Some of them are heading up here, and they are bent. So by the time they arrive at the eye, they come in here, they seem to be coming not from there, but from up there. And that's why we see it, a distorted image. So a gravitational lens. So this is an enormous gravitational lens. There's a rather unusual block there. Now, it's possible from the physics to work out how much gravitational lensing we expect from the mass of all the galaxies here. We can estimate the number of stars, we can allow for the X-ray gas, we can allow for the dust and gas, we can add it all up. And we don't come out a factor of two too little, which wouldn't bother an astronomer. A factor of two is nothing, but we come out more like a factor of 6, 7, or 8. We cannot account for the mass that is required to make these extraordinary distorted images. This distorted image. Why are they distorted? Because it's not a perfect lens. It's more like looking through the sort of glass blob in the bottom of a wine bottle or a beer bottle or something. Or one of those old tea rooms where they have a blob of glass and everything seems distorted. So you can not only, it not only distorts, but it magnifies. So we can study details of maybe star-forming regions in this very distant galaxy that has been hugely magnified by the gravitational effect. Now, there are lots of other lines of evidence for dark matter. Stars go too fast, orbit too fast in our own galaxy. Clusters of galaxies orbit each other too fast. I say too fast compared to the mass we estimated. We just estimated the number of stars. And some people have speculated that the reason for this is that Newton's law of gravity breaks down. It isn't an exactly inverse square law, but maybe a tiny correction. That is referred to as MOND. But the preferred explanation is that this is a real thing. There is matter there that we do not yet know what its nature is. So this observation, which I want to explain, is one of those considered fairly crucial observations that demonstrates that dark matter is real. So, let me explain. We have a cluster of galaxies here, another cluster of galaxies here, and this red blob here, because this is a combination of images, shows X-ray emission from hot gas. Now, okay, what I didn't tell you is that all clusters of galaxies are contained within a halo of hot X-ray gas. We don't have to worry about it, it's very low density, but it does contain a lot of mass, almost, well, as much mass as there is in the individual galaxies. So what has happened here, and I'll show you a diagram, is these two clusters have collided and passed through each other. And when they did, the galaxies interacted, but, you know, passed through undamaged, or maybe triggered some star formation. But the X-ray gas that each of them had actually, like a gas, collided and stalled in the middle. Now, if dark matter did, well, if dark matter was just ordinary matter and Newton's law gone wrong, then we would say there is as much mass in the galaxies as there is in the X-ray gas. So after the collision, we've got one unit of mass in those galaxies, one unit of mass in those galaxies, and two units of mass, because each had one unit of galaxy, one unit of X-ray mass, two units of mass left over in the middle in the big X-ray cloud. Now, we can measure the gravitational lensing of these clusters, and that is encoded by the blue light and shows that the dark matter stayed, just as we would expect, the dark matter halos passed through each other and stayed with the clusters. So there's the situation. Red is X-ray gas, the two clusters come along, blue is dark matter, they collide, pass through each other, leaving the X-ray gas stalled in the middle. But from our measurements, we find that the dark matter stays with the galaxies. So that, we believe, is the case. The dark matter is something real. And the search is on for dark matter. Experiments have been done on Earth, looking for the collision, weakly interacting massive particles are one of the candidates for dark matter, looking for the occasional collision between a dark matter particle and a normal matter particle. Now, I don't have time to explain in detail how this works, but Einstein showed that the geometry of the universe, the way light rays propagate through the universe, depends on the density of matter in the universe. It's the same thing to do with gravitational lensing. Light and matter are the paths they take are bound together. And so it is possible, what we discover is the geometry of the universe, believe it or not, amazingly, it's called Euclidean, that we observe. We can see what the geometry of the universe by looking at the microwave background. That corresponds exactly to the critical density. That means that the energy associated with it, vacuum energy, and the dark matter and the real matter adds up exactly to the critical density. Now, in the old universe, that would have meant the universe would expand forever and come to a halt. But because some of that energy has the effect of accelerating the expansion of space, although we have the critical density, it means the universe will expand and expand forever. But what it does mean is we can draw a pie chart like this and show what, on average, our universe is made of. And that is the stuff of stars, this lecture room, planets, everything that we are familiar with, most of what I'm talking about, makes up only 5% of the contents of the universe. The mysterious dark matter makes up 23%, and the remaining 72% is vacuum energy. Now, Martin Rees doesn't like this diagram because it looks as though it's kind of fixed in space and time, and it's not. The universe always has that critical density, but in the past when it was smaller, the proportion of vacuum energy was much smaller. When the universe was very young, you could completely ignore vacuum energy. In the far distant future, it may be, and will be, that the proportions of these two will become less and less, and the universe will be entirely dominated by this. If we take this 5% and just see how that is made up, well, most of that 5% is still in the form of hydrogen and helium left over from the Big Bang. 0.8% is in stars and elements beyond helium. That's all the stuff of this room. Only constitutes 0.025% of the universe. Now, I want to say, we nearly run out of time, and maybe there'll be time for questions, maybe there won't, but what I promised to do is to hang around in the tea room area, and people are outside, and people can speak to me afterwards. I just want to, something that very much confuses people is, I talked about vacuum energy, so they want to know, what's vacuum energy doing in this room, in the solar system? The answer is nothing, because in our solar system, we are dominated by the ordinary matter. I've got a number up there, 8 times 10 to the 8. That is number of solar masses per cubic light year. Very strange way of measuring density. If you want, if you're familiar with the density of water, then it's 4 times 10 to the 20. That's the density of water in terms of solar masses per cubic light year. But the point is, our solar system has got lots of mass in it. It may not look like it, it's a heck of a lot of empty space, but you know, compared with really empty space, there's a lot of mass there. So matter dominates. By the time we get into the average for a galaxy, the density's gone from 8 times 10 to the 8 down to 1 times 10 to the minus 3, a thousandth of a solar mass per cubic parsec. And then dark matter is never condensed into small objects. It always stays well inflated because it can't condense, it can't radiate energy away, starts to control things. And it's only when we get out to the average density of the entire universe, which we can only sample when we are a long way between individual clusters of galaxies, that vacuum energy, with that density, average density of 4 times 10 to the minus 9, 10 to the 17 powers less dense than the matter in our solar system. So that is why, you know, inside a galaxy, there's no Hubble expansion, because gravity is keeping the thing in shape, and angular momentum is stopping it all collapse. And it's only on the larger scales that vacuum energy dominates. Now, I have to say, far into the future, that may not be the case. Vacuum energy will eventually, we don't know its nature, but if it is just as simple a force as I've described, it will eventually tear everything apart. Now, I'm going to round this up very, very quickly now with something I promised you. This is called the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. Here we are looking back to a time when the universe was a 20th its present age. It actually took about 800 exposures, taken over 11 days with the Hubble Space Telescope, all added together, and all the cosmic rays cancelled out and background subtracted to produce this image. Of course, it is an image taken here in our galaxy, looking deep into space. So there is a star in our own galaxy. And then there are some relatively nearby galaxies. But when we look deep here, we see a view very different from that cluster, Virgo cluster of galaxies. Instead of seeing grand design spirals, a little bit like this one, we see lots of individual little fragments, tiny little irregular galaxies. Now, if we could rush over to this place in space right now in an instant, we wouldn't see any of these galaxies because they have long since merged and collided to form individual grand design spirals. But this is just an example of how when we look deep into space, we look far back in time, and in principle, the entire history of galaxy evolution is written in this particular image. But of course, this image is biased because we are only looking in optical light. If we want to get a complete picture, we would need to look in infrared, because a lot of the important galaxies are completely invisible here because they are shrouded in dust and gas. Incidentally, we are looking so deep into space that the normal law that says the further away something is, the smaller it looks, its angular size gets smaller, no longer applies. As we look deeper and deeper, because space itself is shrinking, the volume of the universe is shrinking, galaxy angular diameters actually start to increase again. Now, the simplest thing you can do with this is count the number of galaxies. And in fact, I used to say there are about 3,500, but they're more like 10,000, and they are in an area about the size, that's the area in relation to the moon. You can scale up that area, there it is, the Hubble Deep Field, count the galaxies, scale it up, to estimate how many galaxies can you see in the entire observable universe, and it comes out to about 100,000 million. So the number of galaxies in the observable universe is about 100,000 million. The number of stars in a galaxy is about 100,000 million. And to put us back into the picture, the number of cells in the human brain is also about 100,000 million. Just puts us back in the picture. The big difference, of course, between this, and that is, in the human brain, the cells are multiply interconnected, giving the number of possible permutations and combinations that far exceeds any number that we can find in the universe. Now, I think that is within about 20 seconds of quitting time, so I'll stop there. I didn't notice there's nobody in control, I guess. I put the lights on, I guess. I suppose we don't really have time for questions, but I'm very happy to answer questions. Must a star be in the galaxy? Are there orphan stars of Earth? The simple answer to that is they don't have to be in galaxies. Some stars are expelled from galaxies, and we have found them in intergalactic space in clusters. And they can be stars in binaries where one star expels and the other one is cut off. So there are a few. Yes.
Second law of thermodynamics suggests that entropy is increasing, and I was always told in physics when I was a student that means in the end the whole universe is going to be some one grey dull matter. Does that hold?
Yes, entropy is increasing. He was told in physics that the universe will be one dull grey whatever. And the question is that true? The answer is yes. We live in a unique time when these forces seem to be about balanced. The background radiation is 2.7 degrees at the moment from the microwave. It will go closer and closer to zero. The universe will get faster and become dark and empty. And the black holes will even evaporate. So we're living quite early. We're in a very youthful universe. Yes. The dust, yes, I'm not going to talk specifically about dust. Dust are the heavy elements, stuff of this room, that are made in stars and then are, when the star comes to the end of its life, are spread out into interstellar space. And I'll tell you about that tomorrow. But that's basically it. So heavy elements, silicates, all kinds of things like that. A star isn't resolved. That's a technical term. That means that the resolving power of our telescope, the ability to see in fine detail, is not sufficient to show a star as a round body with a finite diameter. It just looks like a point of light. We'd say an unresolved point of light. Yeah. Any other? Yes.
Looking at the black hole telescope, it seemed to go back around 13 billion years, and you said the Earth had all got started about 13.7 billion years. Can we see that star? Does it take us back that far?
No, the Hubble telescope, we'll see at the start of stellar evolution, almost as an aside, but we are going back within about 800 million years of the start of the universe with the Hubble telescope. With optical telescopes, we can push further back towards the origin, but there is a limit at 300,000 years, which at that stage the universe was uniformly hot about 3,000 degrees, and photons were scattered. So that microwave image, microwave background, I'll show the picture tomorrow, is the limit we can go with optical telescopes. Beyond that, we have to it gets to large hadron colliders and things like that. And don't really do that. But there we are. We've gone to the Hubble ultra deep field, and then we get back here to when the universe becomes transparent. Now we're on the logarithmic scale. And that was when the universe was about 300,000 years old. Most of the really exciting stuff had happened by the time the universe was a second old. Go back to the Planck time. And you guys talking about the Large Hadron Collider, that was what the universe was like when it was about a millionth of a second old. But already a lot of really exciting stuff had happened even before. That's a logarithmic scale. This is a linear scale. So you either say you know almost everything, you've seen almost everything there is to see in the universe in linear time, but in logarithmic time, where we can get to, 300,000 years, which is up where this arrow converges, we've seen almost nothing, all the really exciting stuff. Okay, any other questions? And that's Any other questions?
What is a variable star?
Oh, a variable star is a star that varies in brightness. It goes bright, faint, with a very accurately repeating period, maybe every 100 days. And there's a very nice relationships between the absolute brightness, that's the true brightness of such a variable star, and its period. A lot of work done at this observatory and at this university hinges around the study of variable stars in the galaxy, in the Magellanic Clouds. Okay. I think that's all.